Hey, everybody, it's Kevin and it's Donna, and welcome to the first episode of the Med List. Donna, are you excited?
So excited. It's a great week. I love the name. I love the graphics, and it's just fun.
We'll jump right in. We'll kick it off with this graphic. All right. So Donna, we have a special guest with us, but beforehand, since it's episode one, Thank you everybody that's able to join us this evening, depending on where you're watching from across the coast. So we have 2:30 my time, Pacific time. And Donna, what time is it in your neck of the woods?
It's 5:30 and it's pitch blackout.
All right. So if you guys can join us, we'd love to have you. We're really looking at different perspectives with the Med List. So Donna and I were really passionate about trying to broaden who we're speaking to instead of just talking to clinicians or just talking to the patient groups. We'd like to talk to everybody, you know, and start bringing some folks together, because that's where half the burden is we don't talk the same language. And we oftentimes don't coordinate care as well as we'd like to. So that is a big goal of the Med List. My name is Kevin Walker. I've been a pharmacist for too long now, a little over a decade. I've been a pharmacy director in the hospital world, moved into the digital health space, and just love and appreciate the woman over to my right. And I'm so thankful to be able to work with her. Donna, brief intro for you. And would you please introduce Jane, our guest, too?
Yeah, absolutely. So Kevin, like you, you had mentioned that there's this disparity of, you know, who's communicating, right? And I've always thought pharmacists are right in the middle. We have the providers on one side and the patients on the other side, and we're the perfect people to be bringing everybody together. So this is what we're trying to do for everybody with the Med List. And just a little bit about me. I've been a little bit more than a decade as to being a pharmacist. I'm approaching three decades, which is a little crazy in my head. But anyways, I love every minute of it. And I'm just glad that I'm able to share my knowledge and learn more, because that's what we do, right? We teach and learn regularly throughout pharmacy. And today we have Dr. Jane LePage, who is a dear friend of mine and colleague. And so we both work in hospital pharmacy, but I do a lot of just the more transitions of care. I'm not dispensing at all. And Jane, on the other hand, she's doing a lot of the hospital pharmacy, you know, hands-on hospital pharmacy too. So I'm so glad to share perspectives with you today.
Great to have you. I'm going to just throw out that I've been a pharmacist for over 40 years. And again, anytime somebody asks me what I do for a living, I say that I'm a pharmacist. I don't say that it doesn't go any further than that. That's what I love, is being that.
Yeah. Love it. I love that pride in the profession. So folks, today the episode is all about the dangers of transitions of care. And all three of us have worked in it. Jane works in it and quite actively. And Jane, if you would give us a little more background on your role in the transitions of care world and kind of give our audience a briefing on what that actually means.
So my role at the university is I'm an associate professor at Mass College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, and my practice site is an advanced institutional rotation. So the focus with me and my students and I is on hospital pharmacy operations. But beyond that, before coming to the university, I actually was an operations manager in a hospital, and I still am a per diem pharmacist at that hospital. So I actually still work as a hospital pharmacist at least 10 hours a week, sometimes a little bit more.
Wow. And so as a hospital pharmacist, when we're talking about transitions of care, I think there's a certain perspective that we have because we're in a certain juncture of that transition. But for most folks, when they're thinking about it, Jane, when they're thinking about what is a transition of care, you know, can you talk about broadly?
So it's really any point that, whether it's in the emergency department where the patient is giving their medication list to whoever they're giving it to, a nurse, an assistant, a physician, that is one transition of care. If they are admitted to the hospital, that is a transition of care. If they go to surgery or the ICU, those are all transitions of care. Whenever they're going from one environment to another, that's an opportunity. That is literally a transition of care.
Yeah, I think in just the word itself, like that transition, like there is a translation risk that happens with each one of those in different ways, shapes, and form. You know, during this episode, I know we won't have time to cover each one of those transitions. We'll probably broadly talk more about admission and discharge. So admission, meaning you're in an outpatient setting and you're getting admitted to a facility to be able to take taken care of on an acute basis. You had an injury, you had an illness that cropped up and you need acute care, meaning emergency room care or hospitalization. And then upon discharge, you're done with that period of care. You've gotten to a stable point, or a family member is at a stable point, and now you're getting transitioned over to going back either home or to another facility for what's called step down, oftentimes going to a skilled nursing facility or a rehab facility. So Jane, in that kind of world and in that space in general, what you're working with your students right now, tell us on the front side, on the admission side, what kinds of things are you doing to make sure that patients successfully transition from being outpatient to being inpatient?
So a few years ago, I was actually involved with my students in initiating a transition of care and medication reconciliation program in a large academic medical center, which is where my practice site is. And what we were literally doing was taking the medication list ourselves from the patient or family member. And that happens in a variety of ways. There are people that bring in a medication list. If somebody's coming in from a skilled nursing facility, they've got a list from that facility. Or it may be possible that a family member is giving you the medication list, or that three people are telling you what the medication list is all at the same time. So what the students and I did is that we took that list, whether it was we personally obtained it or some other member of the healthcare team obtained it, and we verified everything that was on that medication list. And that's medication reconciliation, where you are going to whatever you have for resources, and that may involve calling the outpatient pharmacy, where, you know, calling the CVS or Walgreens and actually asking for a medication list from the pharmacist that is there. It may involve getting in touch with the primary care physician or provider and verifying what that list is. Also, there's a repository, I believe it's called SureScripts, that all outpatient prescriptions go into, but that would only be if that was somebody like independent pharmacies don't subscribe to that necessarily. I don't believe the VA has their information in there. So it's not always accurate. It's not always available and it's not always accurate. So what we would be doing is verifying that is the accurate medication list, that is all that the patient is on, that they haven't omitted anything, and that everything that they have given us that they are still taking, that they are still supposed to be taking. And also we have the opportunity at that point to have a conversation a little bit about their compliance, or if we're going into that SureScripts and we can see when they're getting their refills and when they're getting fills. So that tells us a little bit about their medication history as well. I have to say that at that time, it was a pilot program, and we probably looked at a little over 100 patients, and I believe that the statistic was over 65% of the patients, if there was some discrepancy from what they gave us for their original medication list to what their actual medication list would be. And that involved medications like insulin and inhalers and clopidogrel and some things that we really want to know whether is the patient taking it and are they still supposed to be taking it. So that's one area that I've had some experience in. I have to say the other area where I have more experience currently is as a hospital pharmacist, when the patient is admitted and you are seeing their admissions orders and actually reviewing what their admissions orders are and relating them to what they have been admitted for and what's been discontinued and what has been continued from their home med list.
That's so helpful. So for the audience, what Jane was really describing there on from a patient's perspective, and all the pitfalls in between are, if you don't have a current med list, right? I mean, the show is called Med List. Let's plug it in. If you don't have a current med list of all the medications that you and your family members are currently taking, great time to start one, right? Mm-hmm. And the other pieces that Jane talks about that may have been lost in some translation is this, but she's talking about it now at the hospital admission component, is if you were on a medication, but not actually taking the medication or not taking it as prescribed, really important information to be able to transfer over to the admitting facility and to the pharmacist taking care of you. Because oftentimes there's another error potential. You're saying that you're taking a given medication, it's been prescribed to you in a certain way, but that's not how you're doing so at home. Another really good piece of information to make sure you're keeping updated on. And then the last thing I wanted to plug in was Jane talked about three like specific individuals or groups that oftentimes we're pulling information from: the patients or family members, the pharmacy for dispensing records, or the primary care provider for, as I'm using all my fingers here, primary care provider to be able to see what that medication list was. So the importance of all three of those is a list that is the same across all three. And so making sure you're keeping everybody updated is a huge benefit. But Donna, any things to plug in?
Well, what I wanted to say is, Jane, thank you so much for highlighting how many different places we actually get med lists from and whether or not they're updated or not. And that's something that I will often say and also teach my students. And I'm just going to throw a plug in there too. It's also in the book Med Strong. So, and I talk about that. I talk about the difficulty that there is in all these places where you might keep meds or not. So there are things, you know, from we're trying to figure out where things came from. The hospital where I'm at, I'm able to see a dispensing history. So I'm able to see what they've been getting that way. But it doesn't show everything, doesn't show all the OTCs necessarily. It might show some, but not all of them. And then maybe some supplements or herbals too. So we have to remember to include everything. And then as the clinician side of things, we have to be able to make certain we're asking. And when we're looking at OTCs and we're looking at various supplements and, you know, the non-prescription meds, we have to figure that even if they're not being prescribed, the patient is self-prescribing those. And when we're self-prescribing, we're trying to treat something. We're trying to feel better about something. We're trying to prevent something. So what is that we're trying to treat or prevent or take care of? And is it appropriate? So not only is it important that you have a list of your meds, but make certain that it's the prescription and non-prescription and that you understand why. Or if not, if there's a question mark, then we have to start asking that too, you know, why as clinicians, why are we taking this? Or you might have to, you know, ask, you know, what's your purpose? So so great places to be asking questions and finding questions to ask.
Love it. You've already led us down the journey, Jane, now to the point where our hospital pharmacists are getting their teeth into what's actually going on and how to take care of them. Can you walk us down that one next?
So as a hospital pharmacist, you should have access to what the person's home med list is. And then there is the med list that they're on when they're in the hospital. And many items on the home med list are often discontinued while the person is hospitalized for a variety of reasons. If somebody has had a fall or somebody has a mental status change, it's absolutely, you know, you would imagine that they're going to discontinue some medication. Sometimes they discontinue everything and start over. A lot of times those over-the-counter medications or supplements are automatically discontinued. And a lot of times hospitals or institutions have certain protocols or certain order sets that depend on what the patient is coming in for. So say you're coming in for a knee or hip replacement, there's going to be a certain order set that all of those items on that order set are automatically going to be ordered for a patient unless they have allergies to them. So now you're the hospital pharmacist and the Joint Commission requires that all medications that are prior to administration in a hospital have a prospective drug review by a pharmacist. Now, we know that there are some areas or some medications where the acuity of the situation may be that the medication has to be administered. It can't wait for the pharmacist to verify it in the emergency department or the ICU or maybe in surgery or something like that. But those situations need to be rare. They need to absolutely be the exception and not the rule. So as the hospital pharmacist, you're looking at all of the medications that have been prescribed for that patient since they have come into the hospital. And that is, to me, so that's essential in order to be sure that what is being ordered for that patient, depending on what they came for, what their allergy information is, their height and weight and serum creatinine and their age, any clearly we're always looking at renal function, that all of that is appropriate. So now you've got the med list for the patient that's in the hospital bed. That's all been verified by the pharmacist. And again, it may contain all of their medications that they were on as an outpatient, or it may contain very few of them. Especially if they're an ICU patient, then it would be much more likely that fewer of those medications that they were on as an outpatient have followed them into the hospital.
Where do you see the errors popping up there, Jane, most often? Sometimes they're out of our hands. Where are the errors that often are from lack of information that the pharmacist may have at their fingertips when those order sets are being added on and verified?
Well, so one of the biggest, it often blows my mind that somebody can get to the point of being in a bed and we don't have their allergy information, or can get to the point of being in a bed and just routine labs are not available. Just what's their serum creatinine? What's their potassium? If they're being ordered a potassium supplementation, why are we doing that? And so a lot of it is missing lab information as well as patient specific information. But a lot of it can be also duplication. Somebody comes in and they're on whatever medications for their blood pressure or whatever their cholesterol or whatever it may be. And then there's automatically an order for something that is in the same drug class or maybe incompatible or maybe, you know, duplication of therapy or all of those medication related problems that we look at.
Makes so much sense. Donna, anything else that you've seen that's been a problem for you on that juncture?
Yeah, I have to agree with Jane again with especially creatinine clearance, kidney function, but also things that just really shouldn't be on the same list as we look for drug-drug interactions and just making certain that those don't get followed through. I think what's important too is, you know, when we're talking about transitions of care, and I know when I'm working with students and trying to teach them where the formularies come into play. And that gets a little sticky. They're like, well, why'd they switch them from omeprazole to pantoprazole? Well, that's on our formulary. So it's not that they're going to necessarily switch that for good for the patient, but it is right now in the hospital where that switch is going to happen. So I think that those formularies, that gets a lot of confusion for either new practitioners, potentially the patients, the caregivers that are in visiting, and then also, you know, just trying to make certain that the right meds or that when I'm getting a little bit of ahead of ourselves, but at discharge that things are reconciled back, if you will, as to what the patient has, or, you know, start, stop, change, whatever it might be, needs to be clearly defined. So I think that those are some things and just some little quick, you know, ideas to really be cognizant on is even the formulary, the dosage itself. So is an extended release versus an immediate release? What's on the hospital formulary? So thinking about metoprolol, is metoprolol succinate or metoprolol tartrate? And what does that mean? And what does it mean for the patient and what they have at home? Another one might be the isosorbides, isosorbide dinitrate or isosorbide mononitrate. And then also, we might see some things like diabetes meds, gliburides and glipizides, if someone's still on a sulfonylurea, for example. So there's a lot of these nitty gritty things, but are we writing new prescriptions and then are they end up going home too? So where does that stand? It's just so important for our patients.
That popped into my head when I was talking also, Donna, one that, you know, the statins that are on formulary. So somebody comes in who has already had an issue with the atorvastatin theoretically, and they don't want to be taking it anymore because they have had issues with it, side effects with it, and they come in on rosuvastatin. Well, we don't carry rosuvastatin, and we automatically change them to atorvastatin because that's our preferred. And again, like you said, with the omeprazole, pantoprazole, that class of medications. So where I think, and I jump ahead also to the point of discharge, where the patient, I mean, people that come in the hospital are very sick. We don't admit people to the hospital unless they're very sick. So they often may be not even aware of the changes that have been made to their medications compared to their home med list. I think that happens with insulin coverage also, that what you do in the hospital is very different probably than when you do as an outpatient. Mm-hmm. And so now we've added a bunch of medications that a patient may or may not have been on as an outpatient, right? We're treating what they came in for, but we've also made a bunch of therapeutic substitutions. And we've added on some sliding scale insulin, and we've added on, you know, a whole bunch of some diphenhydramine out of that order set. And their list of medications is, you know, ridiculous at this point while they're in the hospital. Then you get to the point where they're going to be discharged, right? They've come in, we've treated their infection, we've sent them to the cath lab, we've done whatever it is that we need to do, and now we're going to discharge them. And what are they getting discharged on, and how well do they understand that? Do they go home and take atorvastatin and rosuvastatin? Do they go home and take two different dosage forms of whatever their blood pressure medication may have been? Mm-hmm. Or do they go home and not take anything because nobody had that conversation with them before they were discharged? So we see a variety of pharmacist involvement in that discharge education. Nursing has a huge role in discharge education and discharge counseling. And I absolutely respect nurses in the institutional setting, but some of them do a really good job at that, and some of them don't do a really good job at that. And there are so many other areas of the patient care that the nurse needs to educate them on that the medications aren't always a huge piece of it. To us, it's the biggest piece of it, to pharmacists, but not necessarily to everybody else. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think your guys' salient points really hammer home. And then from the patient perspective, you hit it, Jane, with the someone was having problems with a certain statin previously, and no one is aware of that, right? And that is another transitional care element that a patient should be aware of. If your family member, one, Jane makes 2 points I want to highlight here. One is if you've had previous issues with the medication, to make sure that the clinical team knows that that has occurred. And two, you are oftentimes very sick. Having family support is oftentimes one of the biggest factors in successful transitional care. Having the support of those family members to be there and advocate for your care, and having a strong relationship with the clinicians that are part of that transition in and transition out, are some of the biggest highlights. One thing I wanted to also mention is when it comes to a med list, sometimes when individuals come into the hospital, I've had previous patients that I've gone into rooms and they have gone to another country to get medications that existed on no lists whatsoever. Those medications can sometimes be things like, oh, I take lorazepam every night, or I take other medications that for us as pharmacists draw a red flag of, oh no, we're stopping this medication that we should not be stopping immediately, and we should be checking to make sure you're still on these meds. Mm-hmm. That can be, once again, really important. So having that family history and background is an essential element. And I think even more important into the next piece that Jane's getting into, which is now we're discharged. You've come in, you've been taken care of by your incredible clinical team, and now Jane is trying to help you along with her nurse colleagues to successfully transition out. Where are the pitfalls there, Jane, that we should be looking out for from a clinician perspective and from a patient perspective when we're going from hospital, let's say, to home?
Well, so to me, one of the biggest ones is duplication of therapy. Right. So you've been on pantoprazole while you've been in the hospital, but you take omeprazole at home, and whoever is discharging you and issuing your prescriptions, you know, we don't see a patient leave the hospital with a fistful of prescriptions anymore, right? Everything is prescribed electronically. What pharmacy do you use? And they fire off those prescriptions to the pharmacy, and you don't ever physically see them. Hopefully somebody's reviewing a list so that you can physically review that, but you don't physically see the prescription. So you came in, you're on a rosuvastatin, they change it to atorvastatin. The resident or intern or whoever is issuing your prescriptions when you're being discharged fires off that prescription to your pharmacy for atorvastatin. And you go and your family member goes and picks up your new prescriptions, and it's there in a vial. And so you take it. I mean, if the doctor prescribed it and you need it, then you're going to take it. Yeah. So duplication of therapy is one of the biggest things. I think continuation or discontinuation of medications for sedation or for pain is clearly a huge issue when patients are discharged. What do they need for pain treatment? We discharge people, advising them to follow up with their primary care physician within a week. Well, you can't always contact your primary. What if you're getting discharged on a Friday and you can't call your primary care physician until Monday? And you know they're super busy on Mondays, so nobody gets back in touch with you until Tuesday afternoon. And you've been discharged with 3 or 4 days worth of whatever it may be, antibiotic, pain medication, whatever it may be that you were told to follow up with your primary care physician on. So that follow-up is huge. And the time frame that that follow-up occurs in is also a major issue. Also, I wanted to just, while we've been talking, something else occurred to me, that a lot of patients come to the emergency room alone with their family members, whoever it may be, and they've got their bag of medications with them, right? They've got a brown paper bag or a plastic bag or whatever, a bag from Walmart, and it's all tied up and it's got 14 different things in it. All right, so we don't let that patient use their own meds while they're in the hospital. Now, if they don't tell us that they have their own meds with them, and say somebody's got a purse or a backpack or whatever it may be, and they've got medications with them, we can't have our patients having access to any medications while they're in the hospital other than what we dispense to them. And that's another piece in that original transition of care that we need to be sure that we're accounting for. And if the patient cannot send them those medications home with a family member or loved one, that we store them in the pharmacy so that they cannot take them while they are there in the hospital. And excellent. That's something that is just huge. We see it all the time, that a patient will be sneaking their own lorazepam. Well, they've got it in their purse, or they have it in their pocket or in their belongings or whatever it may be.
Yeah, we could literally have, I think, a whole new episode, Jane, on just POMs, patient-owned meds. I mean, the everything from the logistic nightmares of getting those meds in to be able to account for them, to looking at what kind of integrity they have, to billing for them, to the transitions of care elements of billing for those meds if they're accepted. But I think the one interesting element of that transition out that I wanted to ask both of you about is I've had the unique pleasure of walking my resident physicians and or physicians through the electronic health record, just so everybody out there kind of recognizes what does the physician have to go through when they're doing this. They have to play this incredible game of connect the dots that is brutal for everybody. And the screens that they are looking at to be able to make these connections and to interlay something from really complicated acute care stay to trying to simplify things on an outpatient stay is brutal. And so they oftentimes try to run away as quickly as they can or pass this off to a resident physician to be able to make these matches of here's what you're taking in one area. Here's what I'm discharging from that area or discontinuing, excuse me, from that area. Here's what I'm continuing there. Here's what you're previously taking. And so this match and this interlay is very complex. And so it takes an entire team to look at that, including you as a patient. So it's very important for you to be able to walk that through with your family members and caregivers, because it's not as simple as, oh, they were taking one medication previously. We're going to take them off of that and put them on one new medication. Typically, you're making it to the hospital, as Jane has described, you're very sick. And you're oftentimes taking lots of medications, and lots of medications will be leaving with you. Any thoughts there, Donna and Jane, on that process of when you guys have walked your clinicians through that discharge paperwork?
Jane, do you mind?
Go ahead.
So literally just had this conversation this past week when I did Grand Rounds, and we were talking about deprescribing and went through some different cases. And one of the things that was discussed is, how is it that if we've made changes at the hospital level, how is it that the patient's going home back on what they might have come in on when we intentionally changed that medicine while they're in the hospital? And that was one of the things that came up, is this whole like electronic health system where why isn't the strength just changing automatically for somebody who, you know, say like, all right, we've had to adjust their gabapentin because of renal function or, you know, whatever purpose. Mm-hmm. And so that's been changed and the patient's doing well on that. Why would they ever go home on double the what they came in on, you know? So why isn't that being switched? If it's being switched at the hospital, why isn't there an automatic movement forward in that regard? So so that was like one thing that we had talked about was just that, just what you're talking about, Kevin, is just that confusion. Because I had that question. I haven't had that experience of having to navigate that, you know, area. And it was really interesting to hear the med residents talk about that, and also the physicians too, and how they're trying to like check over what their residents are doing as well. So even when it's done, it still gets a little messy, right? So Jay, I don't know if you have more to add to that, but I have more things to add after.
I just wanted to mention one other thing. When you were talking about the discharge, what people are being discharged on, oftentimes a caseworker has some involvement on the access to medications, because that also is an issue at the point of discharge, at that particular transition of care. If they are being discharged on a new inhaler or a new whatever, one of the DOACs or something like that, it's entirely possible that they're going to get to the pharmacy and find out that they're insurance, their prescription insurance doesn't cover that particular medication. And if that homework is not done prior to discharge, then you're going to have a patient that's going to say to the pharmacist, okay, hang on to that. You know, I'll call my doctor's office and I may or may not do that. And that medication that they are being discharged on to address probably the problem that they came into the hospital on, they're not going to end up taking it once they're discharged. Mm-hmm. So the insurance coverage there, that has to be a piece of the transition of care at the point of discharge.
Huge. Thank you for that, Jane.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Like that whole health system side of things and all the different health systems we've even spoken about in regards to just trying to get information, right? That's a health system in itself from the very first time when somebody's walking into the hospital. Other things I wanted to actually bring up as well as part of the assessment when people are being discharged, if you will, is to be thinking about, you know, how do we reduce rehospitalizations for this patient? Are they going to go home, and what are their chances of getting back here within 30 days time? And of course we want to minimize that. So we talked a little bit about that whole instruction back to the patient, but when we speak with patients and we're talking to them and we're talk about the high hitter things such as heart failure and COPD and falls, those are three major areas where especially older adults tend to be rehospitalized for. When we talk to our patients about it and we'll go bedside and chat with them, we will give action steps and action plans that are provided already available online. So there's a COPD action plan, there's a heart failure action plan, and we can look at the STEADI programs for CDC for falls. So when you're looking at these particularly the COPD and heart failure, it's really mapped out well where, you know, you're looking at, okay, you're in the green zone, you're doing great, you're feeling good and things are going well. And, you know, so, and then you get into the yellow zone with heart failure. Oh, you've gained a few pounds. You've got to take action. Don't wait till it's 10, 20 pounds. You know, so what action are you going to take? Oh, you don't have an appetite. That could be fluid, you know, so let's make certain that you're not having heart failure issues with that. So there's a lot of those good signs and symptoms that we can train our patients so that they're less likely to come back into the hospital, instead take quicker action with their providers and with their primary care physicians. So I really like thinking about that, not just like, here are the meds, but here are some action plans for you. I think that those are super, super important.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good stuff.
And then there's, you know, are there clear instructions or are things confusing? So I know at our hospital, I'm sure many hospitals do this at the discharge. They're doing meds to start, meds to continue, or that might have changed a little bit, and then medications to stop. And it has to be super clear as to what you're doing with each of these medications. So I think that that can be super helpful as well. And then I already talked about like updating the records within the electronic health system throughout all these transitions. And why are we waiting for somebody to input it? It's an electronic health record. Hopefully, you know, this might make somebody think like, oh, we've got to move this forward. And if I'm now only taking 5 milligrams of something versus 10 milligrams, that needs to change. So write in the record, have that be updated. And that would be like, that would be wonderful to see that. The other, as I go on here, the other thing that I think is super important too is for falls prevention, what's somebody's anticholinergic burden? Mm-hmm. So that can be calculated too. That can, you know, an electronic health record should be able to do that for folks so that we can see. And what's really interesting is that when people are hospitalized and they have an anticholinergic burden, they tend to have an increased anticholinergic burden when they're hospitalized. Mm-hmm. And then they end up going home with an increased anticholinergic burden, which means more falls, which means tachycardia, which means confusion, dry mouth, dry eyes, all these things, maybe difficulty swallowing and other issues that can ensue. So we need to be looking at some of those factors as well. So those are important things to me as I think about the assessment of at discharge time as to, you know, who's the patient, what do we have to be thinking about, and what's important before we actually click those discharges and sign off and say, okay, mm-hmm. hopefully we won't see you for a while.
No, those are fantastic highlights, Donna. I know we're getting close to the end of the show, but Jane, here's what I would love from you, if you can close us out with some of these thoughts from you, is if you have a young clinician, pharmacist, nurse that wants to be successful and help their patients transition successfully, let's focus on discharge successfully, what are three of the top tips that you would really highlight for them?
I think it's really important that patients have something to take with them that they can refer to, that they can look at once they, all of the confusion of where's my ride and get me a wheelchair and where's my belongings, that they can take with them. Because we all know when you're counseling patients, a lot of times they'll nod their head and you're assuming that they're understanding you. And they're, it's really, and if you're talking about somebody with, you know, 10 medications on their med list, they can't take all of that in at one time. So yeah. Now the patient is going to get home with their medications and they need to have something that is very precise, as Donna said, that is exactly what they're supposed to be doing. What has been added? What has been discontinued? How, at what time of the day? What does twice a day mean? Does it mean 8 a.m. and noontime? Or does it mean, what does that mean? And that yep. It really needs to be precise. I would think that's one of the biggest takeaways. Again, I think that there needs to be some interaction, some involvement with case management to be sure that this med list that, and the prescriptions that we're sending them home with, that they have access to those medications, that they are going to be able to get them. And not that they're going to be able to get, you know, the first 30-day supply downstairs at your outpatient pharmacy, but then after they go through that 30-day supply, now they're not going to have access. So I think access and the coverage, insurance coverage, how is the patient going to be sure that they can get those medications and take them? And I think that, Dawn, I think even asking the question to the patient, if it is something that people bounce back, you know, within 30 days or within 10 days or however long it is, to have a conversation of what, asking the patient right out, what are you going to do to prevent coming back here with the same problem? What are we going to do to make sure you don't come back here with the same problem? And give them the tools, go through what those tools are. If you have a heart failure clinic somewhere that they can attend or whatever it may be, just being sure that the patient has the tools that they need to prevent that bounce back and that rehospitalization. We know that patients come in and sometimes they get sicker while they're here because of everything that they are exposed to. So we want to keep them out of the hospital.
No, I think that's, well, those are three fantastic tips. And I want to thank Jane for literally walking us through this wildly crazy. American Heart Association did a wonderful job, you know, putting this together. Jane, you did an even better job of walking us through all of these individual steps that can really throw someone off. Donna, I wanted to get your perspective as our last kind of element of saying, this is what patients should think about when they're trying to successfully discharge. I'll throw a few of my thoughts there at the bottom of the screen, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah. So medication optimization, and that's what I live by. So we want to make certain that patients are understanding exactly, like I said before, what they're might be starting, what they're stopping, what they're continuing, what changes there might be. Ask questions. Why? Why do I need this? Could this increase my risk of falling? Could this increase an exacerbation of another issue I have? These are all really important questions. So ask a lot of questions as well. And then just because you go home on something, and I don't mean to say this, but it always, like everything else, needs to follow up and monitor. It's really important. Not everything we switch to is perfect. And then it could be that something was reduced or, you know, stopped, and maybe it needs to be put back on. So always, always, always be working on looking at that follow-up and monitoring, and ask at every single encounter you have healthcare-wise, do you need all of these medicines? Are they all appropriate for you? How can I optimize my medicines?
Beautiful. Beautiful. Awesome. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed this. I know I thoroughly did. Thank you all for joining us. All right.
Thank you so much, Jane. Really appreciate
one of the books, Jane. You knocked us out of the park.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, everybody. Well, thank you guys so much and have a wonderful rest of the evening. Yes. We'll see you guys next week, Monday at 2:30.
On the Netlist.
Great. Right. Yeah. Bye. Take care. Bye now. Thanks.